You know that highly specific feeling of sitting on the couch at like 11 p.m.?
Oh, absolutely. The house is finally quiet.
Right, exactly. The house is quiet, and you've got this cold blue glow from your laptop just illuminating the dark room.
Just staring into the void of real estate.
Yeah. There is this, I don't know, this profound expectation of escapism. You open up yet another batch of Zillow tabs.
We've all been there.
And the photos show these sprawling, sun-drenched homes with giant yards, mature trees, maybe like a little wraparound porch.
And no traffic in sight.
Exactly. And there is this little voice in your head, totally exhausted from the daily grind, that just points at the screen and goes, there it is. That's the way out.
It is the ultimate modern fantasy, really. I mean, we project all of our desire for peace, for financial breathing room, for simplicity onto a literal piece of digital real
We
estate.
really do.
We convince ourselves that just changing our zip code acts as this magic wand, right? Like it instantly dissolves all the complexities of our daily lives.
But then you actually step into the grinding logistics of relocating your entire life.
Which is a whole different reality.
It's massive, especially when you are talking about, extracting your life from the gravitational pull of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, the Bay Area is its own beast entirely.
Right. Suddenly, that beautiful, simple Zillow portal is just shattered. You're staring down this financial, legal, and logistical landscape that is, frankly, really murky.
And intimidating.
Super intimidating. It's full of hidden traps.
Because it's not just a simple property transaction, I think we tend to treat it like we're just buying a very expensive television online.
Just click add to cart.
Right. But moving across state lines, transferring equity, changing tax jurisdictions, that is the absolute definition of a complex life transition.
The real estate is just the vehicle.
Exactly. The real estate gets you there, but the mechanics are so much deeper.
Which is exactly why we're dedicating this deep dive to this specific transition.
And it's a vital one to unpack.
It is. So if you're listening to this on your commute down the 101 right now, or if you've ever just stared at those Zillow tabs feeling completely overwhelmed by this sort of idealized hype of relocating out of California.
The glossy brochures, so to speak.
Right. This conversation is custom built for you because we are pulling apart a brutally honest, entirely math-driven relocation analysis today.
Based on the guide by Gennaro Schaefer, right?
Yes, specifically focused on the Bay Area to Bellingham, Washington pipeline.
And our mission here means we have to throw away those glossy brochures. We are not interested in the marketing copy today.
No marketing fluff allowed.
We are going to break down the actual mechanics, the numbers, the intricate tax realities, the undeniable power of geographic
It's
arbitrage.
just huge.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And perhaps most importantly, for anyone looking at the Pacific Northwest, we're talking about the relentless gray winters.
The ones that conveniently never make it into the listing photos.
Right. Funny how that works.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are going to translate these high-level real estate daydreams into concrete, actionable reality for you.
Step by step.
But we can't start by looking at square footage, right? Or debating quartz versus granite countertops.
That comes way later.
We have to start with the foundational reason anyone is even capable of making this move in the first place.
The equity.
The raw, almost incomprehensible financial leverage of Bay Area equity.
It's staggering. The entire concept of a California homeowner relocating to the Pacific Northwest, it hinges on this one fundamental economic mechanism.
The delta in property values.
Yes, the massive delta. It's the concept of the equity reset. And that serves as the financial engine driving this entire phenomenon.
So let's put some hard numbers to that engine because
Yeah.
the sheer scale of it is what makes this so unique.
Let's do it.
As we look at the data for early 2026, the median single-family home across the nine-county San Francisco Bay Area is sitting right around $1.3 million.
Which is a wild baseline.
It is. And look, if you live on the peninsula or down in the South Bay, places like Cupertino or Mountain View, intimately, that 1.3 million is actually a dramatic underrepresentation.
Oh, yeah. Tried double that in some neighborhoods.
Exactly. Even in parts of the East Bay that used to be considered the quote-unquote affordable suburbs,
Yeah.
it is still just a staggering amount of capital locked up in drywall, wood, and a tiny patch of dirt.
And the thing is, the human brain is remarkably adaptable. which in this specific case is actually a financial detriment.
How so?
Well, Bay Area homeowners get conditioned to these numbers. You watch your home's estimated value climb year after year, and eventually $1.5 million or $1.8 million starts to feel like just a normal, unremarkable number.
Right, for a completely average house.
Exactly. A totally average, maybe aging, 1,500 square foot, three-bedroom house built in 1965.
You get completely desensitized to the fact that you were living inside a massive illiquid piggy bank.
You're sitting on a fortune, but you can't buy groceries with it.
You really can't. But then you take that desensitized perspective and you apply it to a market like Bellingham, Washington,
which is up in Whatcom County near the Canadian border.
Right. A genuinely nice, well-maintained three-bedroom house in a highly desirable Bellingham neighborhood runs roughly $600,000 to $800,000.
With the median hovering right in the low 600s.
So the mechanical reality of a Bay Area sale doesn't just mean you can, like, afford a house in Bellingham?
No, the mechanism here is a total wealth transformation.
The proceeds from the California sale buy the Bellingham house outright, in cash.
And still leave a massive pile of surplus capital on the table.
It's wild. You are taking wealth that was entirely illiquid, trapped in the walls of your house, accessible only by taking on more debt through a HELOC OC.
Right, adding more burden.
Yeah, and you're converting it into highly liquid, deployable capital.
Let's ground this in reality by walking through a specific mechanical case study from the analysis.
Good idea. Let's look at a couple. We'll call them Priya and Dev.
Okay, Priya and Dev.
They own a 1,400 square foot condo near Hayes Valley in San Francisco.
Great location, but small.
Very small. They managed to sell it for $1.35 million. Now, they aren't fully paid off, right? They still owe roughly $480,000 on their mortgage.
Which represents a very standard mid-career tech couple.
Yeah, totally typical.
They've built up very healthy equity through market appreciation, but they still carry a substantial mandatory monthly obligation to the bank.
Right. So let's look at the transaction mechanics here. They sell for $1.35 million. First, they have to pay the friction costs of the transaction.
The real estate commissions, transfer taxes, title fees.
All of that, which typically eats up around 6% of the gross sale price. Then they pay off that $480,000 mortgage.
So what's left?
When the dust settles and escrow closes, the wire transfer that hits their bank account is roughly $790,000 in pure unencumbered cash.
Wow. And the next step in the sequence is taking that $790,000 and deploying it in the Pacific Northwest.
Exactly. They move to Bellingham. They find a 2,400 square foot house built in the 1990s, sitting on a beautiful quarter acre lot up on Bellingham South Hill.
Which is a great neighborhood.
It really is. The purchase price is $720,000.
So they pay for it in cash.
They'll pay in cash. They have zero mortgage. Mm-hmm. And they still have $70,000 left over to pad their savings or do some immediate remodeling.
The mechanism we really need to focus on here isn't just the fact that they bought a house outright.
What is it then?
It is the psychological and operational shift in their daily cash flow.
Oh, the monthly burn rate.
Let's break down their monthly burn rate before and after this transaction. In Hayes Valley, they were carrying a $480,000 mortgage on a $1.35 million property.
Right.
When you add in San Francisco property taxes and the inevitably hefty HOA fee for building in that neighborhood.
Because HOAs there are ridiculous.
Absolutely ridiculous. Their mandatory monthly housing cost was easily hovering around $4,900.
Nearly $5,000 a month, out the door, non-negotiable, just to maintain the right to sleep in their own condo.
Now, compare that to their new operational reality in Bellingham.
It's night and day.
They own a much larger home on a quarter acre of land, free and clear. Their new monthly housing cost is no longer driven by a bank or an HOA.
So what are they actually paying?
It consists entirely of Washington property tax and homeowners insurance. That combined monthly figure drops to just a little over $650.
That is a staggering reduction. $4,900 down to $650.
The crucial takeaway is that Priya and Dev didn't necessarily get richer on paper, right? Their aggregate net worth didn't magically double just because they crossed the Oregon-Washington border.
Right, the assets just shifted.
But they fundamentally restructured the mechanics of their daily existence.
By eliminating the mortgage and the high tax burden?
Exactly. They reclaimed over $4,000 of their own income every single month. That is the true functional meaning of an equity reset.
It's not about inflating the top line net worth number on a spreadsheet.
No, it's about creating massive breathing room in your checking account on the first of every month.
You are quite literally buying back your own stress capacity.
That's a great way to put it.
But I do have to push back a little here just to play devil's advocate, because there is a financial counterargument to this.
Let's hear it.
If I take $790,000 in cash, buy a house outright in Bellingham, and I'm no longer holding a $1.35 million asset in one of the most famously appreciating real estate markets in the world.
The appreciation argument.
Right. Aren't I crippling my long-term net worth? Sure, my monthly cash flow improves today, but I'm trading a rapidly appreciating Bay Area asset for a slower appreciating Bellingham asset.
Which is mathematically true.
So 10 years down the line, won't I have less wealth overall?
That is the exact mathematical tension every buyer has to grapple with. If your sole objective in life is maximizing gross net worth upon death, then yes, holding highly leveraged, hyper-appreciating Bay Area real estate is a proven strategy.
Albeit a very stressful one.
Incredibly stressful. But you have to ask yourself what wealth is actually for. The equity reset thesis argues that wealth trapped in a house you can barely afford to maintain isn't actually serving you.
It's just a number on a screen.
Right. Furthermore, the $4,000 a month you save in housing costs doesn't just disappear into thin air.
Well, you can reinvest it.
Exactly. If you redirect that massive monthly cash flow into diversified index funds, you're trading a highly concentrated, illiquid position, a single piece of dirt on a fault line.
Literally on a fault line.
For a diversified liquid portfolio plus a paid-off primary residence. You fundamentally change the velocity and the utility of your money.
I see what you're saying. You shift from being house rich and cash poor to being genuinely balanced.
Yes, exactly.
And that balance becomes even more extreme in our second scenario from the analysis. Let's talk about the Sunnyvale retiree.
This is a fascinating case study.
This is a woman who bought a classic Sunnyvale ranch house back in the late 1990s. She'd owned this house free and clear for years.
The quintessential Silicon Valley original homeowner.
Yep.
She rode the wave from the dot-com boom all the way through the AI revolution.
And she decides she is just done. She sells this Sunnyvale ranch for $1.9 million.
Amazing return on investment.
Incredible. And because she has no mortgage to pay off, she takes almost all of that, minus closing costs, and heads to Bellingham.
Where does she buy?
She buys a stunning premium view home in the Edgemoor neighborhood, which is a highly desirable luxury pocket of Bellingham, for $850,000 in cash.
So she secures top-tier housing in a new market outright.
Yes. And because she started with nearly $1.9 million clear, she walks away from the title company holding a seven-figure cash cushion.
Over $1 million in liquid capital.
Just sitting there. The money is now doing the work her house used to do. She converted illiquid California dirt into a paid-off Pacific Northwest dream home and simultaneously funded a $1 million investment portfolio to generate income for the rest of her life.
It is a complete financial metamorphosis. And it highlights a critical reality about this specific relocation path.
Which is?
You are not trading down. You are not accepting a dilapidated house or a lesser quality of life just to save a few bucks. You are executing a massive geographic arbitrage.
It's like trading in a high-maintenance, incredibly temperamental luxury sports car for a brand-new, fully-loaded, ultra-reliable SUV.
I like that.
And the dealer just hands you a briefcase containing $1 million in cash and tells you to put it in the passenger seat as you drive off the lot.
That analogy perfectly captures the sheer scale of the windfall. But the sports car metaphor is also apt because sports cars, like Bay Area houses, are notoriously expensive to maintain, even if you own them outright.
Oh, absolutely. Which brings us to the underlying mechanics of hidden carrying costs.
Right. These are the quiet, insidious differences that don't immediately pop out when you are just comparing Zillow prices.
Exactly. Everyone hyper-focuses on the mortgage payment.
But they fail to realize that almost every other cost of homeownership scales with the underlying value of the asset and the local labor market.
It's inescapable.
It is. If you own a $1.5 million house in San Jose, even if you have completely paid off the mortgage, the basic mechanics of existing in that house are fundamentally more expensive than operating a paid-off $700,000 house in Bellingham.
Let's break down those mechanics. Where's the money leaking out?
Start with insurance premiums. The cost to insure a home is intrinsically tied to the replacement cost of the structure.
Right. If it burns down, what does it cost to rebuild?
Exactly. And rebuilding a home in the Bay Area involves Bay Area material costs, Bay Area permitting fees, and Bay Area labor rates.
Which are astronomical.
Therefore, your insurance premiums reflect that inflated risk. And speaking of labor rates, think about basic maintenance and remodel costs.
Yeah, getting a contractor in San Jose is brutal.
If you need a new roof, a new HVAC system, or a kitchen update on a San Jose house, the contractors quoting that job have to pay their crews enough to survive in San Jose.
So the quote is massive.
The quote you get is going to be a wildly inflated compared to the quote for the exact same scope of work on a house in Whatcom County.
It makes sense.
The friction costs of simply existing in a high-value, high-cost-of-living real estate market act as a constant, quiet drain on your wealth.
So you've reshaped your net worth. You've got this liquid capital, this diversified portfolio, a paid-off house, and you've dramatically lowered your daily friction costs.
You're in a great spot.
You're feeling incredibly smart. You've got this briefcase full of cash sitting in the passenger seat. But, and there's always a but, the moment you move that money across state lines, you trigger a whole new web of tax implications.
That the tax man always cometh.
Sacramento wants their cut before you leave, and Olympia is waiting for you when you arrive.
Precisely. You have fundamentally altered your financial footprint, and that puts you directly into the crosshairs of competing state tax policies.
This is where the geographic arbitrage either becomes a masterstroke or a catastrophic miscalculation.
Right, it really is.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the tax flip.
Because if the equity reset is the engine of this move, the tax implications are the steering wheel.
They dictate exactly how much of that wealth you actually get to keep in your own pocket.
And for many people making this migration, the Washington state tax code is the ultimate deciding factor.
It's the headline.
It is. The massive neon sign drawing people north is the zero income tax reality. Washington state does not levy a state tax on personal income.
Period. Zero.
Zero. Which is wild to a Californian.
Let's look at the mechanics of what you are leaving behind. California state income tax is a progressive system. It starts low at 1%, but it aggressively scales all the way up to 13.3%.
And even higher with recent payroll tax additions for the absolute highest earners.
And let's be intellectually honest about the demographic we are talking about here. We aren't talking about minimum wage earners making this move.
No.
If you are a dual income household living in the Bay Area, working in tech, finance, or medicine, you are very likely sitting in a bracket where your effective state income tax rate,
meaning the actual percentage of your total income that goes to the state,
right, is in the 8-10% range.
So let's run the mechanics on that. If you are a household earning $300,000 a year, which frankly is a very standard mid-career compensation package for a tech household in the Bay Area,
very standard,
an 8-10% effective state tax rate means you are systematically sending $24,000 to $30,000 a year to the state government in Sacramento.
That is $2,000 to $2,500 a month, gone before you ever see it.
Every single month.
When you change your legal residency to Washington and your state income tax drops to zero, you are effectively giving yourself an immediate permanent post-tax raise of over $2,000 a month.
That is massive.
For a lot of buyers, particularly those who have negotiated the ability to keep their high-paying remote tech jobs, this single line item does more to transform their monthly budget than the cheaper real estate does.
It's an incredible influx of cash. But I know California homeowners are fiercely protective of their property taxes because of Proposition 13.
Ah, Prop 13.
I hear people say all the time, you know, I can never leave California. My property taxes are locked in. Let's break down the mechanics of Prop 13, because it seems to trap a lot of people in houses that no longer fit their lives.
Proposition 13 is one of the most fascinating and market-distorting pieces of tax legislation in the country.
Passed back in 1978, right?
Yes. It essentially acts as a financial time machine bolted to your living room floor.
I like that visual.
It caps the assessed value of a home at the time of purchase and restricts how much that assessed value can increase year over year. It's legally capped at no more than 2% annually, regardless of how much the actual market value explodes.
So if our Sunnyvale retiree bought her house in 1998 for $350,000, her property taxes are based on that $350,000 assessment. Plus just a tiny 2% bump each year.
Even though the house is now worth $1.9 million on the open market.
She's paying 1998 taxes on 2026 infrastructure.
Exactly. She is heavily insulated from the reality of her own wealth. But the reason I say the time machine is bolted to the floor is that the benefit absolutely does not travel with you.
It stays with the house, or rather the ownership of the house.
Right. The second you sell that house and buy a new one, Even if you downsize within California, you step out of the time machine.
Your taxes reset.
Your new property tax is instantly reassessed at the current market purchase price, typically at a rate of around 1.1 to 1.25%.
Which creates a massive disincentive to ever move.
Huge disincentive.
If you downsize from a $1.9 million house you've owned for 30 years into a $1.2 million condo down the street, your property taxes might actually triple.
Because you are resetting the assessment to the modern market value, you are trapped by your own tax basis.
It's wild.
Now, run the mechanics of moving to Bellingham instead. Whatcom County does not have a Prop 13 equivalent. Homes are assessed near market value, and the effective property tax rate sits around 0.9%.
Now, wait. 0.9% in Washington versus 1.1% in California? On a pure percentage basis, those feel basically identical.
The percentages are close. Yeah. And if a California homeowner compares that 0.9% to their decades-old artificially suppressed Prop 13 tax bill, Washington's taxes might actually look higher on paper.
That's the trap.
But you cannot look at the percentage in a vacuum. You must apply the percentage to the underlying asset value.
The math is undefeated here. Let's do it. 0.9% of a $700,000 Bellingham home is roughly $16,000 a year in property tax.
Okay.
If you had to buy a $1.5 million Bay Area home today, 1.1% of that is $16,500 a year.
Right.
You are saving over $10,000 a year just in property tax friction, simply because the asset you are taxing is half the price.
And that is on top of the zero income tax.
What about sales tax?
The mechanics there are essentially a wash. Bellingham's combined local and state sales tax rate is about 8.8%.
Which is right in line with the 8.6 to 9.9% range most Bay Area residents are already accustomed to paying. Okay, so let me summarize the state of play here. I am moving to escape California taxes. I am saving thousands a month on income tax. I am saving 10 grand a year on property tax. Sales tax is identical.
Sounds pretty good.
This sounds like a pure, utopian, flawless tax haven. I'm packing my bags. But there is a catch, isn't there?
There's always a catch.
The state of Washington isn't just running a charity for displaced Californians.
No state runs a charity, and this is where the nuance is absolutely critical for the exact demographic we are discussing today. Washington State recently enacted a highly specific 7% capital gains tax.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
If I am moving to escape California taxes, but I plan to cash out my massive tech company stock portfolio to fund my early retirement, Washington is standing at the border with a 7% toll booth.
Pretty much.
I thought there was no income tax.
There is no income tax on wages. But let's break down the mechanics of this capital gains tax because it is highly targeted.
How targeted?
The 7% tax applies strictly to long-term capital gains that exceed roughly $270,000 in a single calendar year.
Okay, let's slow down and dissect that mechanism.
Right.
It only hits the amount over $270,000, and it explicitly exempts real estate, right?
Crucial point. The massive gain you realized when you sold your Bay Area house, Washington does not touch a single penny of it. Real estate is fully exempt.
That's a huge relief.
It is. But where this tax creates a shockwave and why any competent relocation advisor will red flag it is for tech workers who are planning to unwind massive restricted stock unit or RSU positions after they move.
Okay, let's walk the listener through exactly how an RSU vests and is taxed, because this is the primary wealth creation vehicle in Silicon Valley.
It's the engine of the tech economy.
It's the classic vest and rest strategy. You work at a major tech company for 10 years. A huge part of your total compensation is paid in company stock. Let's say you accumulate $2 million in RSUs.
Let's track the timeline of those shares. When an RSU vests, meaning it becomes yours to keep, the fair market value of those shares on that specific day is taxed as ordinary income.
Right.
You pay your federal and state income tax on that value immediately. Often, the company automatically sells a portion of the shares just to cover those taxes.
Right, the sell to cover mechanism.
Yes.
So you've already paid ordinary income tax on the value of the stock when it vested.
Yes. But let's say you hold onto those shares for another 5 years and the company's stock price triples.
Which happens a lot.
That massive growth, the difference between the price when the stock vested and the price when you finally sell it, is a capital gain. If you hold it for more than a year, it's a long-term capital gain.
So you moved to Washington thinking you were in a tax-free utopia. You decide you want to buy a yacht or fund a massive trust for your kids. You sell your entire $2 million stock portfolio all at once.
Just cash it all out.
Let's say $1 million of that is pure long-term capital gains.
Under the old Washington rules, that $1 million gain was untaxed at the state level.
But under the new rules?
Under the new rules, the first roughly $270,000 of that gain is exempt. But the remaining $730,000 is subject to the 7% tax.
Oh, wow.
Washington is going to hand you a tax bill for over $51,000.
Ouch. That is a brutal surprise if you aren't expecting it.
Which is exactly why Washington is mostly a tax haven, but it is not a pure bulletproof haven for the tech elite.
So what's the workaround?
The strategy here requires active tax planning. Instead of selling the entire portfolio in 1 year to buy the yacht, a CPA will likely advise you to stagger the sale of those stocks over 4 or 5 years.
Ah, spreading it out.
Right, intentionally keeping your annual realized gains just under that $270,000 threshold, effectively legally bypassing the tax entirely.
It requires discipline and sequencing. You can't just operate on autopilot.
Exactly.
And there's one other specific mechanical tax we need to cover, right? Exit tax. Because Washington gets you on the way out, too.
Yes, the real estate excise tax, commonly referred to as REIT, Washington does not hammer you with high property taxes every year while you live in the house. Instead, they take a cut when you eventually sell it.
How does it work?
The state charges a graduated excise tax that the seller pays at closing.
How does that graduated scale work mechanically?
It's tiered, much like income tax brackets. The first portion of the sale price, up to roughly $500,000, is taxed around 1.1%.
Yep.
The portion of the sale price between $500,000 and $1.5 million is taxed higher, around 1.28%, and it continues to step up for multi-million dollar luxury properties.
So as a buyer arriving from California, you don't feel the REIT at all today. It doesn't impact your purchasing power right now.
Correct.
But you absolutely have to build it into your financial modeling for 10 or 20 years down the line when you decide to downsize or move again.
Precisely. It is a deferred friction cost. It does not negate the massive immediate liquidity and cash flow benefits of the equity reset, but a complete financial analysis demands that you acknowledge it.
Okay, if we step back and synthesize the entire financial architecture of this deep dive so far, the economic trade-off is incredibly, undeniably compelling.
It's a huge win on paper.
You unlock massive trapped equity. You slash your monthly operational costs by thousands of dollars. You give yourself a permanent raise by escaping the California income tax system. The math is pristine.
It really is.
But, as my grandfather used to say, money doesn't buy sunshine.
No amount of geographic arbitrage can alter the tilt of the earth or the reality of atmospheric pressure systems.
Which brings us to the most visceral, non-mathematical part of this relocation. The honest climate trade-off.
This is where the rubber meets the road.
Because if you're leaving California, what are you actually sacrificing to achieve this financial freedom? You're trading away the sky.
And this is where a truly ethical, realistic relocation analysis separates itself from real estate marketing. It is vital to deconstruct what is commonly known as the July marketing reel.
Let's examine that marketing reel. Because the algorithm has fed me these photos on social media, and Bellingham in the summer looks like an absolute unfiltered paradise.
That is because, objectively, it is.
Really?
From roughly the beginning of July through the end of September, the Pacific Northwest, and Bellingham in particular, offers a climate that is arguably unrivaled anywhere in North America.
That's a bold claim.
The mechanics of the summer weather pattern push the jet stream north. The rain stops entirely. The humidity drops. The daily high temperatures lock in around a perfect 75 to 80 degrees.
And because Bellingham is so far north, it's at the 48th parallel, just a few miles south of Canada, the daylight hours in the summer are incredibly long. Right?
Oh, the sun doesn't truly set until almost 10 p.m.
Wow.
The evenings are endless. You have Bellingham Bay dotted with sailboats. The San Juan Islands are just a quick ferry right away. The forests are lush and green. And Mount Baker is sitting on the horizon, glowing pink in the late evening alpenglow.
It sounds intoxicating, and I can completely see the psychological trap here.
The trap is very real.
A Bay Area resident, entirely burned out from a 60-hour work week and a crushing commute on the 880, flies up to Bellingham for a long weekend in August.
Right.
They sit on a patio in Fairhaven, sipping a locally brewed IPA, looking out at the water in perfect 75-degree weather, and they just say, yes, take my money. I want to live inside this postcard forever.
It is the ultimate trap because the July marketing reel is 100% real, but it has an expiration date.
Which is?
It lasts for about 90 days. If you want the financial freedom and you want those spectacular, endless summer evenings, you have to pay the toll.
And the toll is surviving the 230 days of gray.
230 days.
Mechanically, what does that actually mean for the human body and mind? That is well over half the calendar year.
It means an overarching, persistent atmospheric shift. From late October, stretching relentlessly through November, December, January, February, March, and often deep into spring, the jet stream drops south.
And it just sits there.
The entire region sits under a massive, semi-permanent low-pressure system. It is often described as living under a long, soft dome of low cloud and fine rain.
A long, soft dome. That imagery feels almost claustrophobic.
It can be.
But I have to play devil's advocate here. I lived in San Francisco. Anyone who has survived a fogist in the Richmond or Sunset districts knows exactly what bone-chilling gray skies look like.
Sure, San Francisco fog is legendary.
Right. So how different can a Bellingham drizzle really be from Bay Area fog? Are people just being dramatic to scare off fair weather buyers?
It is a fundamentally different meteorological and psychological mechanism. Let's look at the mechanics of San Francisco fog. It is highly dynamic.
It moves around a lot.
Right. It is created by the temperature differential between the cold ocean and the hot inland valleys. The fog rolls in heavily in the morning, but it often burns off by the afternoon.
True.
Or, more importantly, if the fog is locked in and you are truly losing your mind, you can utilize microclimates.
Oh, that's a good point.
You get in your car, drive 30 minutes south down the peninsula to Palo Alto, or east across the Bay Bridge to Walnut Creek, and you are suddenly standing in blazing 85-degree sunshine.
You have an escape hatch.
Exactly. You have localized relief. In Bellingham, you do not have an escape hatch.
Because it's everywhere.
The winter weather is a macro system. It covers the entire region. Furthermore, it is not the dramatic, violent winter of the Northeast or the Midwest.
It's not a blizzard.
It's not a massive blizzard that shuts down the city, forces everyone to build snowmen, and then clears out to reveal bright blue skies reflecting off the snow. It is a persistent, unending dampness.
Just a constant mist.
It is a mist that doesn't seem heavy, but if you walk in it for 20 minutes, you are soaked to the bone.
And what about the daylight mechanics? Because if you are at the 48th parallel, you get endless summer nights, but the pendulum swings violently in the other direction in the winter, doesn't it?
The winter solstice is brutal. In December, the sun struggles above the horizon past 7:30 a.m., and it dips below the horizon before 4:30 p.m.
That's so early.
And remember, the sun isn't actually visible. It is just a slightly lighter shade of gray illuminating the clouds.
Wow. So if you are working a standard tech schedule, you are waking up in the dark, you are commuting to your home office in the dark, you work your shift. By the time you log off at 5 p.m., it is pitch black outside.
Yes. The psychological impact of that cannot be overstated. The lack of vitamin D, the potential for seasonal affective disorder. These are real physiological realities.
You really have to prepare for it.
It creates a heavy, quiet, introspective winter. It forces you indoors. It demands that you find comfort in reading, cooking, or specialized winter gear.
Gore-Tex is a way of life.
It absolutely is. As the analysis notes, this specific kind of relentless damp gets into a certain type of person. It either breaks you or you adapt to it and find it cozy.
Is there any geographic relief up there? Do the mountains block any of the storms?
Yes. There is a localized meteorological mechanism called the rain shadow effect.
How does that work?
The Olympic Mountains and the Vancouver Island ranges can intercept some of the heavy Pacific moisture, creating slightly drier pockets places like Sequim or parts of the San Juan Islands.
Oh, they get less rain.
While they might get less total rainfall volume, they do not magically escape the gray cloud cover. It is a matter of degrees, not a complete climate shift.
So given these intense psychological and meteorological mechanics, how does a buyer actually test themselves? How do you know if you are the type of person who will find the gray cozy rather than soul crushing?
The stress test strategy is brilliant in its simplicity. Do absolutely all of your physical scouting in the dead of winter.
Don't go in August.
Do not buy a house based on an August vacation. You must fly up in November.
You deliberately seek out the worst conditions.
Exactly. You fly into the dome.
Yeah.
The instruction is to go to the specific neighborhood you are targeting and walk the streets on a wet, dreary Tuesday afternoon.
Not a weekend.
Not a Saturday, when the cafes are bustling and people are feeling social. A random working-class Tuesday at 3 p.m. when the light is already failing, the drizzle is constant, and the reality of winter is undeniable.
That is the ultimate crucible. If you can walk through the drizzle at 3 p.m. on a Tuesday in November, and you look at the craftsman houses and the dripping pine trees, and you feel a sense of relief.
Right.
If the town still feels like a place you want to call home, then your geographic arbitrage is going to be wildly successful. But if that wet Tuesday fills you with dread and claustrophobia, then no amount of freed up equity in your bank account is going to prevent you from being miserable.
The weather is the ultimate filter.
Okay, let's assume you pass the November Tuesday stress test. You walk in the rain, you embrace the Gore-Tex lifestyle, and you are ready to pull the trigger.
You're committed.
That brings us to the operational mechanics of the move remote execution and the culture of buying. Because acknowledging that the math makes sense is one thing.
Executing it is another.
Actually, executing a massive, legally binding real estate transaction from 800 miles away without making a catastrophic error is a completely different beast.
Yeah.
How do buyers manage this risk?
It requires an abandonment of the typical casual Zillow scrolling mindset and the adoption of a highly structured, systematic procurement process.
Because you're basically flying blind.
You are operating blind, so you must rely entirely on the operational competence of your local representation. The first step in this mechanical sequence is filtering out what are brilliantly termed photogenic disappointments.
Oh, we all know the photogenic disappointments.
Right. Yeah.
The wide-angle lens that makes a 10-by-10 bedroom look like an airplane hangar.
Yeah.
The hyper-saturated color grading.
It's the strategic cropping.
The strategic cropping that completely hides the fact that the beautiful bay window looks directly into the back of a commercial gas station.
Real estate photography is designed to generate emotional momentum, not to convey reality. So the first mechanical step in remote buying relies entirely on raw, unedited virtual video walkthroughs.
Not the pre-recorded ones.
No. You do not fly up to Washington to look at a house simply because the photos look nice. Instead, your local broker goes to the property, initiates a live FaceTime or Zoom call, and acts as your physical avatar.
And they aren't just pointing the camera at the nice kitchen island.
No, a competent remote broker is actively trying to talk you out of the house.
Really?
Yes. They are pointing the camera at the water stains under the sink. They are taking the camera into the dark, unfinished crawl space to look for moisture.
That's a good broker.
They are walking out to the street and standing there in silence for 2 minutes so you can gauge the actual decibel level of the traffic noise. They are looking at the condition of the neighbor's roof. They are systematically hunting for the flaws that the highlight reel obscures.
That is a phenomenal strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You are preserving your own time, capital, and emotional energy. You are building a highly curated, viable shortlist without ever boarding a plane.
Which leads directly to the second phase of the sequence,
yeah.
The targeted inspection trip.
Okay, what's that?
You hold your position in California until there is highly viable inventory. A short list of perhaps 3 to 5 homes that survived the virtual gauntlet.
And what did the logistics of that physical trip look like?
It is a surgical strike. You fly directly into Bellingham International Airport. Or you fly into Seattle-Tacoma, which is about a 90-minute drive north on Interstate 5.
And you just look at the shortlist.
You fly in for a maximum of 48 hours. You physically walk the top choices to confirm the spatial reality. You identify the target asset, and you immediately fly back to California to initiate the offer sequence.
Let's talk about that offer sequence.
Hmm.
Because if I am hearing this correctly, the culture of buying a house in Washington is mechanically very different from the culture in the Bay Area.
It is night and day.
If you are a California buyer, you have likely been traumatized by Bay Area real estate combat.
The Bay Area market is less a real estate market and more a blood sport.
It truly is. In the Bay Area, to win a competitive house, the mechanics dictate that you must strip away every layer of your own protection.
You waive everything.
You waive the inspection contingency, meaning you buy the house regardless of whether the foundation is cracked. You waive the appraisal contingency, meaning if the bank says the house is worth less than you offered, you have to cover the massive difference in cash.
It's terrifying.
You offer hundreds of thousands of dollars over the asking price. You write deeply personal, slightly desperate love letters to the sellers. It is terrifying.
What is fascinating and profoundly relieving is the massive culture shock California buyers experience when they interact with Washington real estate law and culture.
How does it differ?
Washington, and specifically a secondary market like Bellingham, operates on an inspection-driven culture.
Explain the mechanics of that. How does an offer actually work there?
In Washington, you structure your offer with built-in safety valves. Your earnest money, which is the good faith deposit you put down to secure the contract, typically around 1 to 3% of the purchase price, is submitted to escrow.
Standard stuff.
But crucially, almost every standard contract includes a formal inspection contingency.
So you actually have the legal right to hire a professional to look under the hood before you are legally bound to buy the car.
Exactly. You typically have a window of 3 to 10 days to bring in licensed inspectors. They check the roof, the HVAC, the electrical panels, the plumbing, and the structural integrity.
And if they find issues?
If they find issues, and every house has issues, you do not just have to swallow the cost or walk away and forfeit your earnest money. The mechanics of the contract allow for a formal secondary negotiation.
So if the inspector finds that the water heater is on its last legs and the roof needs patching, what do?
You submit an inspection response. You formally ask the seller to hire professionals to fix those specific items before closing. Or, more commonly, you ask for a financial credit, say $5,000 off the final purchase price, so you can handle the repairs yourself later.
That's so rational.
You are permitted to act like a rational, careful consumer. The anxiety reduction is massive.
Okay, so you negotiate the repairs, the seller agrees, the contingencies are cleared, and the deal is moving forward. We are heading toward closing. Do you have to fly back up to Washington to sit in a mahogany conference room and sign a mountain of paperwork with a wedding pen?
Not at all. The mechanics of closing have been entirely decoupled from physical geography.
Thank goodness.
Washington utilizes title and escrow companies to handle the legal transfer of property and funds. The entire closing sequence can be executed remotely.
Walk me through that sequence. I am sitting in my living room in San Jose. What happens?
Escrow prepares the final settlement statement and the legal deeds. They coordinate with a mobile notary in California. That notary comes directly to your living room in San Jose, verifies your identity, and oversees the physical signing of the documents.
Very convenient.
Those documents are then overnighted back to Washington. Simultaneously, you initiate a secure wire transfer from your California bank to the Washington escrow account.
And then it's sent.
Escrow receives the funds, receives the signed documents, and records the deed with Whatcom County. You are officially the owner. You can literally step foot inside the house for the very first time holding the keys as the legal title holder.
The mechanics are incredibly smooth. But let me introduce the high-stakes complication, the elephant in the room.
Let's hear it.
If my entire equity reset strategy relies on the trapped wealth inside my California house, how do I sequence this?
Ah, the timing.
I need the cash from the California sale to buy the Washington house. But I need the Washington house to live in when I leave California. You are essentially trapped in a high-stakes, multi-million-dollar game of real estate musical chairs. How do buyers bridge that gap without ending up homeless for a month?
This is the most complex logistical mechanism of the entire process, and it is exactly why you cannot improvise this move. You must engineer the sequencing before you ever list your California property.
So what are the options?
There are two primary mechanical solutions to this problem, depending on your risk tolerance and available capital.
Let's start with a scenario where all of my money is entirely trapped in the house. I have very little liquid savings.
In that scenario, you must sell California first. The sequence dictates that your California home goes on the market, you secure a buyer, and you navigate all the way to closing. The wire transfer hits your bank account, giving you the liquid capital necessary to be a cash buyer in Washington.
But the second that California closing happens, I no longer own the house I am sleeping in. Where do my family and my furniture go while I fly up to Washington to find a house?
You utilize a mechanical tool called a rent-back or seller possession after closing agreement.
How does that work?
When you accept the offer on your California house, you negotiate a stipulation that allows you to remain in the property as a renter for 30 to 60 days after closing. You essentially pay the new buyer a daily rate to lease your old house back.
That gives you breathing room.
It gives you a massive tactical advantage. You now have millions of dollars of liquid cash in your bank account. You still have a roof over your head. And you have a 60-day window to fly to Bellingham, make an all-cash offer, close quickly, and sequence the moving trucks without ever being homeless.
That is brilliant. It completely de-risks the capital side of the equation. But what if I am in a hyper-competitive market and I find my dream home in Washington before my California house is even ready to list? I don't want to lose the Washington house.
If you do not want to wait, you utilize the second mechanical solution, a bridge loan or cross-collateralization.
That sounds expensive.
It requires working with a specialized lender. They look at the massive equity in your California house and they extend you a short-term, high-interest loan that bridges the gap. You use the bank's money to buy the Washington house immediately.
So you buy first.
You move your family and your furniture into the new home. Then you clean, stage, and sell the empty California house. When the California house finally closes, the first thing that happens is the bridge loan is paid off in full and the remaining equity drops into your bank account.
So you are taking on temporary debt and paying a premium in interest for a few months to buy yourself logistical convenience and certainty.
Exactly. The core takeaway is that the sequence must be explicitly engineered. You choose your mechanical path based on your capital constraints, and you execute the plan.
Plan the work, work the plan. Okay, so we understand the financial mechanics, we understand the climate trade-offs, we understand the remote buying logistics. Now we have to figure out where to actually point the compass.
The neighborhoods?
Because Bellingham is not just one homogeneous blob of pine trees and coffee shops. It has highly distinct microcultures and architectural zones. Let's map out the neighborhoods, because matching a Bay Area buyer's specific lifestyle expectations to the right zip code is the final critical step.
It is the difference between a successful, deeply fulfilling relocation and immediate expensive regret. The analysis breaks down the topography of Bellingham based on the specific aesthetic and functional desires that California transplants typically demand. Let's start with the most famous and most expensive pocket, Fairhaven.
Fairhaven. Describe the mechanics of this neighborhood. Why does it command a premium?
Fairhaven is the historic South Bay District. It is characterized by beautifully preserved late 1800s brick architecture, cobblestone accents, independent bookstores, high-end boutique restaurants, and the local ferry terminal.
Sounds idyllic.
Crucially, it is highly walkable.
Walkability is the holy grail for a specific type of California buyer.
Yes. The relocation data shows that Fairhaven is the neighborhood that clicks fastest for buyers migrating from Marin County, or the highly curated upscale village pockets of the peninsula places like Palo Alto, Los Gatos, or Los Altos.
People who want to walk to a cafe.
It offers that rare European-style urban connectivity where you can leave your car in the driveway and walk to a waterfront dinner. But because it offers that specific density and historic charm, the mechanical reality is that homes in Fairhaven carry a significant price premium. You are paying heavily for the lifestyle infrastructure.
Okay, what if you are the buyer who says, you know, I spent 30 years living shoulder to shoulder with my neighbors in San Jose. I don't care about walking to a bookstore. I want space, privacy, and prestige. Where do they go?
That buyer is directed immediately to Edgemoor. This is the neighborhood where our Sunnyvale retiree deployed her capital.
Oh.
Edgemoor is the you made it address of Bellingham, but without the suffocating Bay Area price tag.
What does the built environment look like there?
Edgemoor is characterized by significantly larger lot sizes, incredibly mature, towering evergreen trees, winding quiet roads, and most importantly, expansive views of Bellingham Bay and the San Juan Islands.
So it's very private.
It is quiet, it is leafy, and it prioritizes private, insulated luxury over public walkability, though it is only a 5-minute drive down the hill to Fairhaven.
It's the quintessential Pacific Northwest luxury retreat. That we have a middle ground, a transition zone, the South Hill and Sahome neighborhoods.
These neighborhoods thread the needle between connectivity and residential character. The South Hill sits directly above Bellingham Bay. It is packed with older, architecturally significant homes, craftsmen's, Victorians, mid-century moderns.
Lots of character.
It is steep, offering great views, and it is positioned perfectly so you can physically walk down the hill to either Fairhaven or downtown Bellingham. Sahome sits adjacent to it, wrapping around Western Washington University.
What's the vibe there?
These are neighborhoods characterized by front porches, active sidewalks, and a strong sense of community. You will intimately know the names of the people living on your street.
And finally, for the highly pragmatic buyer, we have the northern tier, Berkeley and Cordata.
If you are migrating from a massive, newer development in the East Bay places like San Ramon or Dublin, and your primary metric for success is simply maximizing modern square footage, maintaining low-maintenance infrastructure, and having a 3-car garage, Berkeley and Cordata are the targets.
So it's more suburban.
The trade-off is explicit. You are sacrificing historic brick and ocean views for extreme practicality, modern HVAC systems, and massive open concept floor plans.
The neighborhood matching mechanism is clear, but while we're discussing the physical landscape of Bellingham, we have to address the massive economic constraint that dictates who is even allowed to play this game. We need to talk about the local economy because this is the hardest reality check of the entire concept.
It is the ultimate filtering mechanism, and we must be unapologetically blunt about this. Bellingham is an import-only tech economy.
Explain exactly what that means.
It means that Bellingham does not possess a Bay Area job market. It does not possess an Austin, Texas job market. It doesn't even possess a Seattle job market.
So you can't just find a job there.
If you move to Whatcom County expecting to rely on local, geographically bound industry to support a $250,000 tech salary, you are going to face immediate, catastrophic financial disappointment. The local wages reflect a localized college and service-based economy.
You cannot execute the classic Silicon Valley maneuver of casually job hopping between highly funded startups every 24 months to continuously bump your total compensation. The venture capital ecosystem simply does not exist there.
Full stop. Therefore, the mechanics of this relocation require the buyer to possess one of three things before they ever pack a box: a fully remote, high-earning W-2 position, a highly portable, location-independent business like consulting, or sufficient capital to enter full retirement.
You must bring your own economy with you.
But the paradox is that while the local job market can't support a tech worker, the digital infrastructure absolutely can.
Yes, that is the saving grace that enables this entire migration pattern. Bellingham has invested heavily in widespread, highly reliable gigabit fiber internet,
which is essential.
The digital mechanics of remote work are often superior to what buyers experience in the Bay Area. You can confidently maintain your Silicon Valley employment, conduct uncompressed, high-definition Zoom calls for 8 hours a day, and securely route your California salary straight into your local bank account, all while staring out your home office window at the Canadian Cascades.
You are economically tethered to California, but physically tethered to Washington.
Okay, so you have your remote job secured, your fiber internet is humming, and you are sitting in your beautiful Edgemoor home. Let's talk about the macro lifestyle. What is the actual civic infrastructure like for a town of only 95,000 people? Because if you are arriving from the Bay Area, you are accustomed to having the infrastructure of a global metropolis at your fingertips.
This is where Bellingham punches significantly above its weight class, primarily due to three major institutional pillars. The first, and most foundational to the town's daily energy, is Western Washington University.
Right, WWU. Let's talk about the mechanics of having a university in a town this size. It's not just about students going to class.
The university has roughly 15,000 students. When you inject a demographic that large into a total population of 95,000, it fundamentally alters the cultural gravity of the town.
Keep them young.
It prevents Bellingham from becoming a sleepy, aging retirement community. It guarantees a constant baseline demand for high-quality independent coffee shops, diverse culinary options, public lectures, a vibrant independent music scene, and civic engagement. It provides a level of cultural and intellectual density that simply does not exist in standard rural towns.
That makes perfect sense. The university acts as a cultural engine. But what about physical infrastructure, specifically healthcare? Because if you are the Sunnyvale retiree or even a young family, leaving the towering medical complexes of the Bay Area institutions like Stanford Hospital or UCSF can trigger massive anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when things go wrong?
It is a critical risk factor to assess. The analysis addresses this head on. Bellingham is home to Peace Health St. Joseph Medical Center. The crucial distinction to understand is that this is not a small, underfunded rural clinic where any serious diagnosis requires you to be immediately life-flighted to a major city.
Okay, so it's a real hospital.
It is a comprehensive, serious regional hospital with advanced cardiac, oncology, and trauma capabilities.
But the reality is, it is still a regional hospital. What happens if you encounter a highly specialized, rare medical need that requires top-tier global experts?
That is where the geographic positioning of Bellingham becomes its greatest asset. You are not isolated in the wilderness. You are located exactly 90 minutes south of Seattle, which houses the University of Washington Medical System and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center.
And Vancouver's close too, right?
And you are located 60 minutes south of Vancouver, British Columbia. You have immediate highway-accessible reach to two major international metropolitan areas for complex specialized intervention.
And I imagine Vancouver, BC also serves as the pressure release valve for when you just deeply miss the chaos and density of big city life.
Precisely. When the quiet of Bellingham starts to feel a bit too quiet and you want a genuine world-class international city experience, Michelin-level dining, major stadium concerts, dense urban architecture, or direct international flights to Asia or Europe, Vancouver is literally an hour's drive north. You dip into the metropolis, gorge on the culture, and retreat back to the quiet of the Pacific Northwest by midnight.
And as for the day-to-day lifestyle within Bellingham itself, if you aren't driving to Vancouver, what are you doing with your weekend?
The overarching mechanic of daily life in Bellingham assumes a deep, almost religious reverence for the outdoors.
Nature is everything there.
You have the Mount Baker ski area, 90 minutes to the east, offering some of the deepest snowpacks in North America, and a season that stretches late into the spring. You have the San Juan Islands, a short ferry hop away. You have world-class mountain biking trails carved directly into the hillsides overlooking the city.
And the bay itself.
You have sailing, kayaking, and paddleboarding immediately accessible on Bellingham Bay. The culture dictates that success is defined not by the car you drive, but by the fact that you spent your Saturday navigating a challenging hiking trail rather than navigating a luxury shopping mall.
So if I'm trying to synthesize the underlying mechanics of this entire lifestyle and neighborhood section, the trade-off is incredibly stark and binary.
Very binary.
If your personal definition of a successful life involves walking to a sprawling, hyper-modern tech campus, having a dense network of venture capitalists holding court at your local coffee shop, and possessing the ability to summon an Uber to take you to 50 different Michelin-star restaurants on a Tuesday night, you are looking at the wrong map entirely. Bellingham will suffocate you.
It will feel like exile.
But if your definition of success has evolved, if your priority is securing a flat, private yard for your children, looking up from your laptop to see the sunlight hitting the water of the bay, utilizing gigabit fiber to seamlessly pull a California salary from your home office, and possessing the freedom to log off at 3 p.m. to go skiing on a powder day, then Bellingham is the absolute undeniable bullseye.
It is the execution of a deliberate, highly calculated lifestyle design.
Okay, we are coming into the home stretch of this deep dive. Let's pull all of these complex interlocking threads together, the math, the taxes, the weather, the logistics, and synthesize the core thesis of this entire analysis.
The foundational thesis is this: relocating from the hyperinflated San Francisco Bay Area to a secondary Pacific Northwest market like Bellingham, Washington, represents one of the most powerful, mathematically advantageous real estate maneuvers available in the American economy right now. However, it is only successful if the buyer is willing to accept the uncompromising reality of the trade-offs.
And those trade-offs are not subtle. You are permanently trading reliable, year-round California sunshine for 230 days of persistent, heavy gray skies.
It's a big trade.
You are trading the convenience and endless consumer options of a global megalopolis for the slower, narrower scope of local breweries and outdoor trails. And you are permanently trading the adrenaline and upward mobility of a localized tech boom for the quiet reliance on a remote internet connection.
Yes, but in exchange for accepting those specific heavy concessions, the financial and psychological rewards are structural and genuinely life-altering.
In what way?
You completely eliminate the crushing burden of a massive mortgage, gaining a fully paid-off primary residence. You unlock a staggering multi-six-figure liquid cash cushion. You experience truly stunning world-class summers in one of the most beautiful geographies on Earth.
And zero income tax.
You systematically eliminate your state income tax burden, provided you have the discipline to navigate the capital gains traps carefully.
For you, the listener, the person who has been sitting on the couch, staring at those Zillow tabs, feeling the weight of the Bay Area grind, why does all this granular detail actually matter? Because this is not just a conversation about moving boxes, hiring a truck, and changing your address.
It's much deeper than that.
It is a conversation about reclaiming the mechanics of your own life. It is about aggressively reclaiming your cash flow. It is about taking back your time. It is about recognizing that the geographic struggle you've endured in California has actually built you a massive financial weapon, and it is entirely up to you to leverage that arbitrage to create a tangible, low-stress, highly resilient daily reality.
It is about fundamentally rewriting the mathematical equation of your existence.
But before we close out this deep dive, there is one final, incredibly complex thought I want to leave you with, a concept that builds on the underlying mechanics of everything we've discussed, but pushes it into slightly uncomfortable territory.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Consider the macro mechanics of this trend. Bellingham is a town of roughly 95,000 people. Its local organic industry is relatively small, built around the university, the hospital, and local services.
Yes, the foundational economy is localized, working class, and nature adjacent.
So we have to ask the critical question. What happens mechanically to a fragile ecosystem like that when it is suddenly and continuously flooded by thousands of remote tech workers?
Right.
People who are importing massive distorted Bay Area equity, arriving with all cash offers, and continuing to inject inflated California salaries into a local Pacific Northwest economy. What happens to the local culture, the local affordability, and the housing market for the people who actually work in the coffee shops and the hospitals 5 or 10 years down the line?
You are describing the fundamental mechanics of the gentrification paradox.
Exactly. The uncomfortable question you have to ask yourself is this: are you truly escaping the pressure cooker, the inequality, and the hyper-competitive housing crisis of the Bay Area?
Or are you bringing it with you?
By packing up your massive wealth and your gigabit laptop and moving up the coast, are you simply acting as a vector, helping to build a brand new, miniature version of Silicon Valley in the Pacific Northwest?
It is a profound, morally ambiguous, and fascinating reality to ponder. You might be solving your own housing crisis by initiating someone else's.
It is a heavy thought. And it is exactly the kind of deep systemic reality I want you to chew on tonight. When it's 11 p.m., the room is dark, the house is quiet, and you inevitably open up just one more batch of Zillow tabs to look at the glow of those Pacific Northwest homes. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.